then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man day chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's April the 10th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, for those of you who simply never bother to look at the Thought Crime blog at all, which is the movement equivalent of living in a cave, Bill White was not sentenced last Friday because the judge is extremely ill in the hospital and may die. Now, this is not too surprising, since, as I just learned a few days ago, the judge in Bill's case is 90 years old and a World War II veteran, which means that not only should he not be responsible for judging any other human being at all, but he should not be judging a National Socialist in particular. If the judge dies, Bill is legally entitled to a mistrial, and in any normal case would get one, but then, as we've observed, the United States judicial system obeys its own rules only when it is politically convenient for the power structure to do so. I won't go on with this because I'm sure by now some of you are getting all Bill White'd out, but I must emphasize yet again that this is a purely political case and a highly significant case legally, because some of the outrageous rabbinical judges' rulings regarding Bill White have in essence changed the law without any reference to Congress, which is something the Obama regime specializes in. The Bill White case has removed what used to be called the reasonable man criterion for what constitutes a credible threat, and substituted the purely subjective emotions and feelings of every Tom, Dick, and Harry. One no longer actually has to threaten anybody with any kind of serious or believable threat. It's enough now to, quote-unquote, cause them to feel apprehension or fear, which can mean any damned thing the police or the United States attorney want it to mean, so long as the person who is being caused the apprehension is part of a privileged and politically protected minority. Secondly, the Bill White case has created the legal concept of the quote-unquote inherently criminal and violent audience, which is you guys. And that since stroppy white boys like Bill White and me and everybody else who works on the internet have such an inherently criminal and violent audience, and therefore, when we criticize somebody, it's not the First Amendment, it's a threat. No, I'm not making that up. That is exactly what a Jewish judge ruled in Bill White's case. What this does is it creates a whole new category of third-class citizens, populated by, you guessed it, heterosexual white males. White boys like Bill White and me and you guys. We have no right to speak, or to write a blog, or post to the internet anything that is in any way critical of any government official, any officer of the court, or any politically protected minority, even when such criticism is based on their corrupt and incompetent public job performance. Because, you see, when the Roanoke Times does it, they're journalists. But us being in that special category of inferior citizens created by the Bill White case, when we do it, it's a threat because of our inherently criminal and violent audience, you see. And how does the United States attorney know that our audiences are inherently criminal and violent? Does he know all 10 or 12,000 of you? And let's face it, that's pretty much the size of our wee little internet community. No, he doesn't. But he doesn't have to. A Jewish judge has given his rabbinical ruling that our audiences are inherently criminal and violent. And that's all the U.S. attorney needs, a permission slip from a judicial rabbi to do any goddamn thing he wants to anybody. Maybe even send FBI gunmen to shoot someone down in their home like they murdered Ibrahim Todashev in Orlando, which was, by the way, perfectly legal under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011. And don't you love that term, judicial rabbi, by the way? Now, that's Bill White. Those of you who didn't read his article on judicial legislation, drop me an email with your address and I'll send you a copy of the Northwest Observer it appears in. But one way or the other, looks like there won't be any forward motion of any kind until the judge shuffles off this mortal coil, so things on the Bill White front will probably be a bit static for a while. Okay, email from one of our Erics, although I can never remember where this particular Eric is geographically. Dear HAC, what trade schools do you have in the Northwest? What trade would you recommend a young man learn in order to support myself comfortably and live in the city? I'm seriously considering migrating ASAP and looking at apartments in the Puget Sound region. I have seen really cheap and clean one-bedroom apartments. However, I want to do this right and have a job lined up, hence the main question. What trade should I pick? I'm looking at the maritime industry. Signed, Eric. Okay, first off, as to what school you want to go to, that obviously depends on what kind of trade you want to learn. You also want to pick some community college or other school which will not involve you in running up $50,000 in student loan debt. You need to get hold of every scholarship and every bit of non-usurious assistance you possibly can. There are some pretty significant economic differences between the coastal area and what's called the Inland Northwest, which usually refers to North Idaho and eastern Washington around Spokane, but it can also refer to the high desert areas around Boise and in eastern Oregon and the Tri-Cities area of Washington, which is Kennewick, Pasco, and one other town whose name escapes me. And by the way, that is some very nice country. If you're not one of these people like me who likes to live near the sea, that Inland Northwest area is one of the few truly livable areas of this continent remaining. Now, you will have to put up with some pretty harsh winters. But, you know, hey, everything's a trade-off. Most of the timber industry is concentrated in the more inland areas I just mentioned, and also here in the Olympic Peninsula. So, if you want to live in a rural area, you might want to concentrate on any trade that has to do with paper and pulp or servicing that industry. Say, driving an 18-wheeler timber truck or repairing and maintaining various types of heavy equipment. Now, if you're into vampires, you could even go up on the peninsula here and live in Forks, Washington, which is an actual timber town up here. And the Twilight movies were filmed there, and you can go into restaurants and see all the Team Jacob and Team Edward crap in the guest book and all that kind of crap. Or you can acquire industrial skills involving paper and pulp processing or basic engineering and technician stuff that can be applied in any factory. Now, the Northwest is one of the few places left in the country that has any manufacturing left. Boeing managed to beat off the unions, and they got another major contract recently, so they won't be moving to South Carolina. Although, I gather Microsoft is now pretty much all Asian macacas on the IT and software design end now. They do have a lot of white IT guys at Microsoft still, but they're all contractors, temps, so they can be fired on a moment's notice for a politically incorrect joke or whatever. Now, it's kind of legendary around town now that you don't get vested, i.e. you don't get hired on full-time with full benefits at Microsoft, unless either you've got a brown skin or you fuck other men in the ass. Now, normal American white boys simply don't have a chance for full company employment at Microsoft unless you are connected, you've got somebody in Redmond who has pull, what they used to call a rabbi in the FBI, so forth and so on. But if you can get on as a contractor, you can still make some pretty big bucks at Microsoft, starting at about $21 an hour, I have heard, although I don't know how up to date that is. And it depends on what kind of IT degree you have, when you pretty much do have to have a degree. Depending on how long you can shuffle into work in Redmond every day and keep your head respectfully bowed before the macacas and before the feminist department heads and all that crap, that's how long you can make those big bucks. And contractor or not, Microsoft always looks good on a resume. And women can also get pretty high-paying admin and cubicle jobs at Microsoft. Although, once again, they have to start through the agencies, and I understand with women there's also a bad age discrimination problem there. The maritime stuff you asked about, Eric, is obviously going to be concentrated on the coast where the ocean is. The Puget Sound is hog heaven for anyone who can do anything at all with or about boats or ships. fix their engines, fix their navigation systems, fix their radios, fix their electronics, work in their manufacture, work in shipyards and dry docks, whatever. I think we've even got jobs for good old-fashioned riveters around here still. We have got Navy out the wazoo all over the Puget Sound area, and they employ boku civilian contractors, welders, mechanics, tool and die makers, machinists, what have you. We have had guys involved in the movement who were also merchant marines, sailors, commercial fishermen, so forth and so on. The city of Seattle is surrounded by water on one side, if that makes any sense. You'll see what I mean when you get here. Anything to do with water that requires skills, you can pretty much write your own ticket here. Despite Seattle's reputation for liberalism, you have to bear in mind that it really is 80% white here. And of the non-white minorities, a large percentage are Asians who are nowhere near as violent and criminal and welfare-dependent as the niggers and the beaners. I will say this for the gooks. They work. And so they don't constitute the kind of drag on the economy and the infrastructure that the blacks and the browns do. Now, the result here is that due to its predominantly white population, Seattle is one of the few remaining American cities that actually functions on a reasonably efficient and productive level. The same is true of Portland, only a little less so, because they do have significantly more niggers in Portland. Although, like Seattle, the population is still overwhelmingly white. And like Seattle, the city has an undeserved reputation for liberalism because the Democrat machine has got a lock on the city government and disproportionate wealth is in liberal hands. Now, that's another thing you have to remember about this business of the Pacific Northwest allegedly being liberal. The power elites who rule in Seattle and Portland aren't just liberals. They are rich liberals, very much part of the 1%, with the emphasis on rich. In Obama's America, it doesn't matter who has the numbers, it matters who has the bucks. Well, let's face it, things have always been like that, but today the wrong people have all the bucks. Portland is also a port city. Now, there are deep water docks there and a lot of container ships that come up the Columbia River. I used to watch them sail by every day down in Astoria. Portland is, in fact, a major container port, and so any skills that you can acquire which would be viable in a major shipping center like that would help. And by the way, you don't necessarily have to be a horny-handed son of labor to qualify for these careers. A lot of white men, I've found, still have this 1950s idea that honest work consists of going to a hangar 8 hours a day and banging on things. But these days, everything runs on computers, and so if you're good with computers or IT, I mean really good, not just video game playing good, and you will need a proper qualification to even get in the door, you will be able to get something, not just in the cities, but anywhere in the homeland. Okay, who's next? Gretchen or Olivia? Gretchen, I think.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss a fairly rare book. It's called God's Law, and it's by an author who wrote under the pseudonym Anton Holzner, but his real name was Albrecht Hartzell. And this was an SS officer that had been a former priest. And so he wanted to write a series of books dealing with the transition from obedient Catholic to National Socialist activist. And so he writes about this character of Peter. And Peter is kind of your proverbial everyman. He's kind of, you know, he could be pretty much anyone. And it's the story of a boy who goes to Catholic school and eventually goes to seminary. He has a very pious mother, and he matures within the church. He's instructed by the discipline of the church. He's a natural leader, and he tends to be rather unruly, but the church helps him to settle down, and so he grows in his experience of the church. But he also has to repress certain things. He's very nationalistic, for example. And so eventually, after he becomes a priest, he starts to be drawn to the movement. Eventually, he becomes so conflicted about, on the one hand, being a priest, and on the other hand, being drawn to this political movement, that he actually leaves the priesthood. Over time, as a priest, he begins to question whether the Judaic Bible is necessary or even correct for a German following. And, of course, this idea is reinforced as he gets involved in politics. Now, as a priest, theological arguments were often very important to Peter, but as he becomes involved in the movement and leaves the priesthood, these arguments no longer mean anything to him. He comes to a place where he thinks with the blood. He has a self-awareness at the genome level, and he sees himself as part of the folk, and he humbles himself to work for the party. He does whatever the party needs him to do, and he really puts the church behind him. He doesn't hate the church, nor does he have any interest in things such as Protestant churches, for example, because he's at a new level of awareness. Now, his pious mother writes to him and asks if he's in the faith, and he says that he has a natural faith. He has an old yet new realization of spirituality. And he puts this very tactfully for his pious mother, but he really doesn't need the church per se anymore, but he says that he's still obeying God's law. Now, the fifth chapter is very profound because that's the chapter where this small book or pamphlet really comes together and coalesces, and you see this new vision. As I said last week, I got this from Third Reich Books, and it's a group in Nebraska. They have a whole series of books. They're all very small, and they're only $10 a piece, and they don't have any extraneous commentary in them. Now, the next book I'm going to be reviewing is Kurt Egger's book. He was also an SS officer that wrote these fairly... Well, actually, this book is a bit longer. This book is actually 139 pages, so you can't really call it a small book. Maybe it's some size. But at any rate, he also wrote these types of books, and this one is called The Birth of the New Millennium. And so I've already ordered that one, and it should be on its way to me very soon. And I really have to say I'm very enthusiastic about these books. They're very well written, and if you're going to take the time to read anything, I would find some of these and read them. What this book is really about, it's about being a professional. And what I mean by that is a professional is someone who is willing to transform their entire belief system and thus their entire life. An amateur is someone who likes to perhaps complain once in a while, might make a post on the internet or might tell a joke or something, but it's not really a lifetime commitment. So what's so great about this book is it's very eloquently written, but it's also about someone who makes TLC, and that makes it very impressive and very much worth reading. So I would very much suggest that everyone should look at this book company and find some of these philosophical treatises and pick them up and make use of them. Hail victory, comrade.
One 100 years ago, the catastrophe began. 100 years ago, the white race, having achieved the greatest pinnacle of culture, civilization, and prosperity in human history, ruling 2/3 of the globe, decided that we were bored with it all, and we figured, hey, let's disembowel ourselves. Wouldn't that be cool? They say that whom the gods would destroy, they first make mad. This is Makeham and Clancy. Thank you.
Private William McBride. Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside? And I'll rest for a while in the warm summer sun. I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. And I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the dead heroes in 1915. Well, I hope you died quick and I hope you died clean. Our Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they sound the fife lowly? Did the rifles fire o'er you as they lowered you down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did you leave a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined. And though you died back in 1915, to some faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name? Enshrined forever behind a glass frame, in an old photograph torn and tattered and stained, and fading to yellow in a bound leather frame. Do they beat the drums slowly? Do they sound the fife lowly? Do the rifles fire o'er you as they lower you down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Well, the sun's shining now on these green fields of France. A warm wind blows gently and the red poppies dance. The trenches have vanished under the plough. No gas and no barbed wire, no guns firing now. But here in this graveyard it is still no man's land. The countless white crosses in mute witness stand to man's blind indifference to his fellow man, to a whole generation who was butchered and damned. Do they beat the drums slowly? Do they sound the fife lowly? Do the rifles fire o'er you as they lower you down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? The pipes play the flowers of the forest. And I can't help but wonder now, Willie McBride, to all those who lie here, know why they died. Did you really believe them when they told you the cause? Did you really believe that this war would end wars? Well, the suffering, the sorrow, and the glory, the shame, the killing, the dying, it was all done in vain. For Willie McBride, it's all happened again. And again, and again, and again, and again. Do they beat the drums slowly? Do they sound the fife lowly? Do the rifles fire o'er you as they lower you down? did the bugle sing the last post in chorus, did the pipes play the flowers of the forest.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. This is Andy Donner. Last week, I promised you all Real Politics 4, which is to be a discussion on race itself. That's not what you're getting today, and for that, I apologize. My weekend got away from me, and as a result, I wasn't able to finish work on the presentation. It's similar to the first talk I gave in the series on the Constitution of the United States, in that I have to look certain things up and make sure I'm getting them exactly right, or else the entire thing falls apart. I've got a slightly different take on the answer Mr. Covington had for Jason, who asked, "What would the party do with $10 million?" As far as questions go, that's not a bad one. Mr. Covington gave a perfectly good answer and did a proper amount of admonishing you all along with it. My differing perspective has to do with part of Mr. Covington's answer. You'll recall that the topic quickly went from finances to what people need to do. And what's more, migration and homecoming weren't really brought up until the very end of his response. What hasn't sunk in, at least in my opinion, about the task of creating our own independent all-white nation in the Pacific Northwest as a solution to white genocide, is that it's no different from any other problem. Like any other problem, white genocide is going to be solved by people. Human beings, whites specifically, are what make things happen. Their skills, effort, and actions are what change the world, not money or other resources. The question asked had nothing at all wrong with it, and as far as I can tell, it was sincere. I hope you all will take what Mr. Covington said to heart and understand that we need you. Not your verbal support. Not your online accolades. Not your well wishes, and certainly not your movement baggage. The Northwest Front has made it clear what we intend to do, and because of what we need to accomplish, your help is needed right here. The critical mass we need for Phase 1 of the Butler Plan isn't going to happen without people. Period. As Mr. Covington said in response to someone else, the issue isn't can we win, but will we win. How do we make white people choose to win? This question was asked by Robert, who followed up on last week's Radio Free Northwest episode. Aside from the obvious issue of human nature dictating that we can't make someone do something they really don't want to do, there's a bit of a problem with the question itself. I doubt Robert meant to connote the perspective I'm going to respond to, but we are so frequently asked this type of question that I'm compelled to handle it anyway. But first, some background. When I first started college, I picked up a couple of interesting observations from a leftist hag of an anthropology professor trying to relay a particular concept. Another student had responded to the liberal coursework by saying she didn't like all this political stuff because she was conservative. The fallacy should be obvious. Conservative is a political position just as much as any other, so complaining about politics as a whole isn't viable because anyone doing so has a political stance. Another example of this concept is ethnicity and food. All foods, like the people who make them, have ethnicity attached to them. We've all seen the aisles in grocery stores labeled ethnic food, and they're a real misnomer. The entire grocery store should be labeled as such, because not only the food on the ethnic aisle has ethnicity. The professor was trying to convey that it's very difficult to talk about problems objectively, because more often than not, everyone doing the talking has a connection to the issue they don't want to admit. I'm not going to beat up on Robert because I don't actually know anything about him. For all I know, nothing of what I'm about to say applies to him, and he really does have standing to ask the question he asked. The sentiment behind the question itself is actually wrong. How do we get white people to choose to win? That doesn't seem to be a problem, but who is we? White people? Maybe, but in actuality, the question was asked in response to something about the Northwest Front's intentions. For those of you who have asked a similar question, are you one of us? Remember, the party doesn't have members, but if it did, the first requirement would be living in the proposed homeland. And more importantly, the concept of getting other people to do things you want done, outside of the human nature aspect I spoke about a couple of weeks ago, is troublesome from a white character standpoint. Recall the talks I did on white character. Part of our problem is not changing ourselves before we ask other people to do the same. Have you, who wonder about white inaction, made the choice to win? Have you come home and followed the party's contact procedures? If so, excellent. If not, do you understand why this question is, at the very, very best, extremely awkward? In case you're wondering, it's even more awkward for us to have to answer. I'd like to think some of you are starting to understand what I mean. When Mr. Covington began answering Jason's question last week, one of the provisions he put on his answer was, after we work through our character issues. The problems with the sentiment of what are we going to do to get white people to choose to win are those very same character issues. Just like the girl in that anthropology class, it's not acceptable for white nationalists to discuss what they think needs to happen like they aren't involved. If we're all white here, then white genocide is aimed at us. Asking what we're going to do, when what you really mean is what are other people going to do, is intellectually evasive and morally repugnant. Hints aside, since I'm running out of ways to say it, if you haven't done what you need to do and therefore you haven't come home, you don't need to worry about anyone but yourself. How do you get you to make the choice to win? Once you've crossed that bridge and become involved with the Northwest Front and its associates, then we can talk about what else needs to happen. I really hope this is starting to resonate because I'm running dangerously low on ways of making the damn point. Hail victory, comrades.
Good afternoon, comrades. I'm Olivia from Seattle. I recently received an article from a comrade regarding the murder of a white man in Southeast London, which sparked a lengthy conversation covering many topics, ranging from the race of the victim not being openly revealed, although watching the video, it was fairly easy to see that the victim was white, to rednecks, guns, and racism, and finally ending up on spirituality, religion, honor, and integrity. Although we touched on many things throughout the conversation, some of which are very important and really do need to be said, aired out, and worked through, the thing that stood out for me as most important at this point in time was the topic of honor and integrity. The point of this particular conversation had nothing to do with religion or spirituality, but I found the timing interesting in light of the fact that I had recently been doing some research on white religious beliefs, where I found references to honor and integrity being an integral part of who white people are and a main component of their societies and how they practice their spirituality and religion when they are at the top of their game. The particular information I'm referring to comes from the 14words.net website on a page discussing Aryan or white spirituality. When I first read the article, I was struck with the truth contained in it, although the author clearly states at the beginning that this is simply his opinion based on his studies and insights. I felt he defined a major problem facing us as a race right now, and since I can't say it any better than he did in quoting Alfred Rosenberg from Race and Race History, I'll simply quote what he says. There are two values which embody the almost 2,000-year-old conflict between church and race: theology and belief, enforced belief and pride in character. Two values which are rooted in will and which are now battling for supremacy in Europe: love and honor. He goes on to state that love and honor cannot coexist and share the limelight. One will eventually become dominant, because honor is not always loving, and likewise love is not always honorable. He defines love as the love of humanity, or humanitarianism. Basically, the world we live in today of the Judeo-Christian tendency toward charity and love of all, despite any character flaws which might be present, which creates a society that accepts all people regardless of their character or background. A society based on love depends on the values imposed from outside to find or instill a sense of goodness in all of its citizens, and tends to take either a humanistic or an original sin approach to belief and judgment. It is based on the belief that all are created equal and have the same potential for growth and goodness, with the original sin component being the great leveler of all people. Its ultimate goal is to psychologically weaken anyone who has a high opinion of himself and produce people who are humble and love all of humanity, regardless of what they do or how they act. We've seen the horrible, disastrous results of living in this kind of society. Honor and integrity are ridiculed, and pride in oneself and one's race, especially if you're white, are not only mocked, but can have serious legal and even physical consequences. Please understand, I'm not talking about the Christianity of the past when absolute moral values existed and were honored, but about what passes for Christianity in this time and place and in this particular society. In essence, Judeo-Christianity. He then goes on to define honor as elitism, anarchism or fascism, and aesthetic or warlike tendencies towards self-overcoming. Anarchism in this context reflects the Aryan values of freedom and honor, where responsibility is placed solely on the head of the members of the society. Fascism is defined as the value of honor in that it seeks to place those who prove their honorable character and their excellence in a given field in the higher ranks of that field, thus recognizing that we are all not created equal. When honor is the defining characteristic of a society, as opposed to love, certain individuals stand above the majority in character, excellence, and honor, and they should be recognized and respected accordingly, rather than lowered to the standard of the rest of humanity. From honor comes other values such as freedom, responsibility, virility, nobility, individual integrity, and so forth. In a society based on honor, honor is the moral compass, and life is based on doing what is right from the heart and taking full responsibility for our actions. Of course, this type of society can only flourish when the majority of society holds the same values, as happens in a racially homogeneous society, since races left to develop on their own tend to hold many values in common. Healthy white societies of the past were based on the value of honor and excellence, not only in a given field of endeavor, but also personal excellence was pursued with vigor and zeal. These societies formed men and women of character with many great accomplishments, where loss of personal honor meant loss of standing in society. This is in stark contrast to the societies of today, where anything goes and honor and integrity are cast aside as being of no value, just so much baggage from the past. It is the value of honor that separates white spirituality and philosophy from that of all other races. It is also the value of honor combined with that of integrity, which separates white society from all others. Only in a society based on race and honor can a white man or woman reach his or her full potential. We, as a people and as individuals, need to recover our honor and our sense of integrity, both of which have been stolen from us by the society we have allowed the Jews to create. Yes, we have participated in our own demise in that we, as a race, have valued the admiration of others and being part of the group more than we have valued our own honor and integrity. It's time to step up to the plate and recognize that without our honor and integrity, we are nothing, because it is honor and integrity that ultimately define who we are. The Northwest Front is seeking men and women who put the values of honor and integrity first in their lives and are willing to do what it takes to secure the existence of our race and create a future for white children, regardless of what anyone around them thinks. Men and women who have the vision of what an all-white society can really be. Are you one of them? If so, we look forward to seeing you here in the homeland soon, where we're working to achieve this vision. Hail victory, comrades!
Another email here, or rather a question, that was left on the NorthwestFront.org website by a guy named Andrew, who didn't leave his address so he could get his white book and introductory packet, and so I have no idea who or where he is. Dear HAC, what are your thoughts on national anarchism? Do you think it would be a good idea to have white national anarchist communities dwelling in the homeland once the republic is established? It would be good if you could address this on a podcast. Okay, Andrew, I will address it on a podcast, although I rather doubt you'll like the answer. I have no opinion at all on national anarchism, whatever that is, because national anarchism is not what we're going to be doing in order to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. We're going to be doing Northwest Migration, and then we're going to be establishing the Northwest American Republic using the 2006 draft constitution, which you'll find in your party manual, as a temporary form of government until such time as we can safely hold a constitutional convention, just like the U.S. Constitution wasn't promulgated for some years after the Revolutionary War and the British surrender at Yorktown. National anarchism is just something that we chatter about on the Internet in order to pretend that we're doing something when we are not, and in order to give us an excuse to continue to do nothing, when in fact it is now clear that there is one, let me repeat that, only one plan of action anywhere in our entire wee little movement. Now, I have been challenging the other fearless leaders, such as they are, to come up with an alternate strategy for 12 years now. They got nothing, and they ain't gonna ever have nothing. Now, there is only one choice. Northwest imperative, yes or no. Are we going to go northwest, or is the white race going to perish from the face of the earth? Those are our two choices. Nothing else. And talking about anything else is a foolish and criminally negligent waste of time. You know, it's been a while since I've had a real bluegrass rouser on here. This is Ralph Stanley.
I don't believe I'll go. I don't believe I'll go. Keep down trouble, don't believe I'll go. I've got a mule to ride. I've got a mule to ride. Ain't got no saddle, but I'm raring to ride. The duck said to the drake.
What did you say?
The duck said to the drake.
Quack, quack.
If you get my body, you have to swim this lake. I've got a mule to ride. I've got a mule to ride. Ain't got no saddle, but I'm raring to ride.
Born on a mountain, saw a little king. Sweet little Honda Jane. Go to Rocky Island. Ho, honey, ho. See my candy darling. You know all of her soul. big white horse going to feed him home. Put a little girl to stay at home and feed him when I'm gone. Going to Rocky Island, ho, oh, honey, ho, ho, ho. See my candy darling, you know I love her so. When I was 11 years old, my mother taught me to play this style, an old tune called Shout Little Louie. Since that time, I recorded it and played it all over the world. People seem to like it, and I hope you'll enjoy it here tonight. I play it and sing it as much as I could, like my mother taught me.
Motherfucker! Remember that crap? Well, I have a dream too, and I'm going to tell you about it. I promised you last week that I would describe to you my personal vision of how this Northwest Front thing should work out in practice once I can somehow get through to the thousands of people who listen to this podcast every week and convince you to bring that vision into being. Not many thousands, to be sure, but we only need 1,000 or so to get the ball rolling. Now, that's nothing. 30 years ago, a Hindu con man calling himself the Bhagwan Rajneesh was able to bring something like 10,000 followers into the Dales up in Oregon, and he almost took over Wasco County by signing them up on the voter rolls, until his commune there collapsed into tax fraud and criminality when the women of his harem started poisoning the townspeople, tried to murder his doctor, tried to murder a prosecutor, and they were also poisoning each other as part of their stupid little intrigues. Damn, they sound almost as bad as our movement. Starship Ruthie's been dead for 20 years now, but I keep hearing she still has a lot of weirded-out followers living like moles in underground bunkers in Montana waiting for the mothership to descend. God, I wish we were a nut cult. We'd do so much better. No, really, this always floors me. White people will hand over their entire fortunes and follow some lunatic or not-white freak to the ends of the earth, but getting $10 a month out of you guys and persuading the tiniest handful of you to come here and live in communities to kick off the Butler Plan, which will secure the existence of our people and the future for white children, is like pulling teeth. What in God's name is wrong with you? Now, maybe that should be the topic for next week's podcast. But never mind that. Now, this week we're going to take a trip to Fantasyland and see a world in a Northwest Front that should be. my own version of Martin Lucifer Kuhn's sick and twisted I Have a Dream speech. I dream that tonight some kind of vision from God or the gods or the spirit of the universe or the great pumpkin or whoever or whatever is in charge will descend on all of you. And tomorrow morning when you wake up, you will stagger into the bathroom and stare into the mirror, and that huge crashing sound you hear will be the scales falling from your eyes. You will understand that this time around it's a business trip, and your life does not belong to you. It belongs to your race and to a new nation as yet unborn. You will understand that there is such a thing as duty, and that you are failing in yours. You will understand that there is such a thing as honor, and every day you spend outside the Northwest homeland stains yours until you burnish it clean and bright by coming here and making your life in the homeland where you're supposed to be. You will understand that there is such a thing as moral courage as well as physical courage, and that God requires you to exercise it. You will understand that what happens to you is not important. What happens to your race is. If you're affluent, you will understand that God did not give you that wealth to buy possessions or toys or drugs or alcohol to poison your body with, or to leave to your useless brainwashed liberal children, or to buy yourself a big middle-class palace in a gated community to die in like the old man in the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey. He gave you that wealth in order that at the appropriate time you should place it at the command of the 14 words. And that time is now. So you will come home here to the Pacific Northwest, bringing your ass and your assets. What will you find here in my vision of this not perfect but much improved world? You will most likely not find big, huge numbers of white people waddling down the street on a weekend holding signs and shepherded along by the police. That tactic doesn't work, even if we could get the numbers. The entire system is designed to resist it and circumvent it, and has been doing so for 50 years. Now, I don't rule anything out, of course. I've learned never to do that. But there will be a definite Northwest Front presence here, and you will find a party that is organized into small activity groups of between 4 and 5 people, a lot of them. There will be some NF presence in every community in the Northwest, even the little towns of 700 people out in the Idaho High Desert and the northern border pine forests. Because of your work in breaking through the media blackout, everyone in the Northwest will know that we are here. And everyone will know that there is an independence movement bent on bringing an end to this insufferable tyranny under which we live. Now, most of the white people in the community will know who their local racists are, and they will be liked and respected because they are more or less normal people who hold down jobs, who are raising children, who do not in any way look strange or weird, who speak in a normal tone of voice about normal things, and who do not constantly rant and babble dementedly about Bilderbergers or cover their bodies with extreme tattoos. The NF people will blend in to the community so that the police and the regime's other servants will have difficulty locating them, and there'll be so many of us that keeping us all under 24/7 surveillance will be an impossible task. We will be an inextricable and inextractable part of Northwest society from now on. And yet the party's presence will be known. NF slogans and emblems will mysteriously appear spray-painted on walls, and leaflets will be slipped under doors or otherwise magically appear in people's hands. Small meetings will take place every day and night all around the Northwest, in private homes and garages and offices and public places, right under the noses of the Zionist authorities and their hired gunmen and the police. And at those meetings, strange, wicked, subversive, and politically incorrect ideas will be discussed, and things will be planned. The internet will be crawling with us. Literally thousands of YouTubes and podcasts and websites and blogs. So many that any attempt to run us off the internet will be impossible and won't even be attempted. Whether the dictatorship likes it or not, our opinion on things will matter. The media will constantly be seeking us out to slander and discredit us and make us look like fools, true, but they will no longer be able to ignore us because they will know absolutely that the thing they tried so long to prevent has happened in spite of them. The white man now has a voice, and it is not a conservative or religious or Republican or a single-issue voice, but a voice for complete change in North America from top to bottom. I'm not going to get into all kinds of nitpicky details because basically that would be crystal ball gazing. And crystal ball gazing is never a good idea for us, since the entire situation in this country is now so fluid and volatile that everything can change overnight. That attack on Iran I was so worried about 2 years ago could still happen if Benjamin Netanyahu's mental trolley runs off the rails, and all of a sudden we're looking at a massive war in the Middle East and $18 per gallon gasoline. I suppose it's even possible that Obama and the leaders of the so-called Western democracies are sufficiently insane to start a war with Russia over the Ukraine, although I admit that as paranoid as I am, even I find that hard to believe. Hopefully, the same Pentagon generals who sat Barry down and explained the military facts of life to him and stopped him from invading Syria will prevail again. You will understand that I am talking here about a party mindset, a human quality that I hope we will somehow once again find within our own characters. There is no reason at all why we cannot create the kind of NF I just described over the next few years. The question, as always, is, will we? You know, back in the day, I always figured that if I died in Ireland, I'd want something like this song played at my funeral. This is the Pogues.
Oh, Harold, you haven't shared enough vision for us. Please, Daddy, tell us a story.
I promised no crystal ball gazing, and I really have thought a lot about sharing this with you, whether or not it's a good idea, but as I said early on, white people who will not respond to save their people from extinction apparently will respond to mystical bullshit. So what the fornication? I'll tell you a story. All my life, since I was a very young child, I have had, well, odd things happen to me on occasion. Now, this is something that I never talk about. So listen up, little children. This is the first and the last time I will ever discuss any of this in public. Now, if you want to think I'm making it up or that I've lost my marbles, fine. I don't give a rat's ass what you think. But this is the truth. It happened. In April 2009, I was making preparations to move up here to the Puget Sound area from Astoria, Oregon, which is one of the loveliest and whitest places remaining on this continent. I've always loved it down there because it's the closest thing to Ireland I've ever been able to find here in America. Astoria is situated at the mouth of the Columbia River, and on the Oregon side there's a long, flat asphalt path called, of course, the Riverwalk. I describe some of these things in my novel, The Brigade, which was written in Astoria. Anyway, on a nice spring afternoon in '09, I was taking one of my last long walks down the Riverwalk. On the shore was a large boathouse-type thingy, prefab, attached to the marina there. Not sure exactly what the building was, but it had a large American flag flying over it. Big one, at least 6x4, maybe larger. I walked down to the bridge, and I turned back, and I started walking back toward the Safeway where I had parked my car. And as I was strolling along there, I looked to my right, and I saw the building that I just mentioned. But this time, something was different, and I stopped in my tracks, and I stared. For a moment, I thought I was losing my mind, and I may have been. Whatever this was, it was most definitely not a trick of the light or an optical illusion of any kind. It was definitely there. I could see it. So either I really was completely insane for a minute or so, or else it was something else. In place of the American flag flying over that prefab building over the water, which had definitely been there only a few minutes before, I saw a large northwest tricolor whipping in the river wind off that flagstaff. Nothing else unusual, just the flag. It lasted for about 30 seconds, and then the red, white, and blue Masonic dish rag was back in its place. That's it. Now, I'm sure that the Behavioral Analysis Unit at Quantico, or whatever they call the FBI Psycho Squad these days, is going to have a field day with this. I don't know what to tell you. It was there. I saw it. Either I was crazy as a loon for about 30 seconds, or else someone or something out there was having a brief moment of mercy on me and letting me see the future through a quick rip in the space-time continuum or something. Or maybe just a possible future. I have no idea. Like I said, these things happened to me on occasion, so I just filed it away in my life's already extensive funny file of the memory and more or less forgot about it, although since this one was a good experience, I do trot it out and remember every now and then. Now, why am I telling you guys this? Because maybe the reason that you aren't coming home is because I'm not some kind of weirded-out swami like the Rajneesh in a turban who promises you eternal truth or mystical revelation. For about 30 seconds, I got a glimpse of the world that I promise you. God alone knows how far into the future. God alone knows how much blood and sweat and tears and suffering it will take to put that flag back up over that shed on the Columbia River for good one day. All I know is it's possible. I believe, but that's easy. I always have. Now you need to believe as well. Anyway, our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.